KUOW is made possible in part with support from listeners like you. Consider making a quick one-time donation of $10 via your mobile phone. It's easy. Just text the letters KUOW to the number 27722, and thanks.
Welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. Get on Twitter right now, at KUOW, our Facebook page, KUOW Public Radio, because in the next hour, you and I are going to solve every problem that came up this week, thanks to my guests, Democratic State Senator Pramila Jayapal from the 37th. That's South Seattle, down to Renton
South
International
Seattle.
District.
Yep.
Welcome.
Down to Renton. Thank you.
Thanks for coming,
Thank
Senator.
You.
Joni Balter, host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail. Hey, Joni.
Hey, good morning.
Nice to see you again.
She's my state senator.
Yay.
That's right. Paul Guppy, Vice President for Research at the Washington Policy Center. Good to see you, Paul.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Problem number one. We're going to solve them all this hour. The top box office film this week is a children's movie that tells our kids that the universe contains a force that has two sides.
The dark side. And the light.
Dark and light, and you have to choose. Now, of course, this is the same theory that gives us racism, terrorism, and xenophobia and war. And yet, some parents, and I don't want to accuse everyone, but some parents are not only taking their children to this, they'll buy the kids miniature weapons and warships. And they're not just dropping the kids off. Even some adults, I understand, are going into the theater, watching this movie, and they walk out congratulating themselves on being one of the good people, not an evil person who needs to be blown up. So that's the problem. What can we do about it? Any ideas?
Children's movie.
Yeah. it's not a children's movie?
I love Star Wars. I remember seeing Star Wars when it first came out in Seattle back in the 70s, and I've liked the series. I agree with critics or fans who sometimes say that each episode is not always as good as the first one or two. In the world of movies, Star Wars is one of the rare examples of when a sequel is as good or is equal to the original movie when that came out, The Empire Strikes Back.
So you saw the original movie, what, one time?
I saw
maybe
it,
two.
As I mentioned to the producer, I saw it seven times the summer that it came out. And not that I'm such a fanatic, but just friends of mine kept going to it, and I would go along with them. I ended up seeing it a bunch over the summer.
You wanted them to be your friend.
I was in high school, so it's not like I had any other obligations during the day.
I see.
So I went to matinees and things like that.
So you're saying we don't even have a problem. You're saying you're acting like Star Wars is not even a problem.
I think it's a great story. I love science fiction. I think it creates an entire futuristic world. And of course, what makes science fiction great is that it also reflects on our society today and makes commentary about those issues. And the main one
simplistic commentary.
Well, of course,
good, bad.
As the dark side and the light side, I think, reflects what we recognize inside each of us.
Oh, really?
We each have to make choices about right and wrong, dark and light, and Star Wars is picking up on that.
Well, Bill, you seem to be sort of most troubled by the simplistic part of this, the good versus evil, and is that too basic or too simple?
Me versus you. That's right. One of us has to be right.
Yeah, there's that, and it'll end up being me. But but think of other movies. You got to start somewhere as a parent. What's the difference between good and bad? And go back in time, you know, The Sound of Music. Good people and bad people. Wizard of Oz, good people and bad people.
It was all a dream.
So you have to start somewhere, and then that's where the parents come in about the grays. And if you think about it, and if you read that story about children's attention span because of our smartphones dropping from 12 seconds to 8 seconds, a little less than a goldfish, which is at 9 seconds, you got to work fast as parents, but you got to teach the grays over time. That's what parenting is.
Okay, so the solution to the Manichaean dualism, good and bad, light and dark side, is to expose your kids to it and then teach them the nuance.
Yeah, I got to agree that, first of all, I'm excited to go see Star Wars, even though I have not seen the first one seven times. But if you want to take on the good versus bad, light versus dark thing, you got to take on every single movie, every single story. I mean, the way they teach plot and writing is there's a hero and there's a villain, right?
Yes, and that's because they want you to sell tickets.
Yeah.
But you don't have to buy into that, right?
No,
good, bad.
But I think that there's a whole bunch of movies in the art realm that are really fabulous that actually go right to the gray. I mean, I think that's what's interesting about a lot of those, you know, independent art films. But there are, there's also, I've seen The Hunger Games because my son read that whole series first. And that's very much in the same thing, in the same mode as well. So I say it's all about what you do with the experience when you go in there. So you go in there, and then do you buy your kids 50 million Star Wars weapons? And no, I mean, we don't, you know, at least in my house, that's not what we do. But do you talk about, well, this was really simplistic, and why was it simplistic? You know, yes, I think that's really what, you know, what it comes down to. But in the end, people are going to go for enjoyment. That's why these big movies are big, and that's why they sell. So
at least in The Hunger Games, wasn't The Hunger Games that we were being run by corrupted people? Like, we're all corruptible? At least it wasn't an outside universal.
Oh, The Hunger Games is horrible in many ways, because
you
put everybody into the middle and you make them fight against each other and kill each other. I mean, I don't know why.
But they're pawns of corrupted, terrible people.
There are some libertarian commentators who like The Hunger Games because it's resistance against state power, and that's a theme that they like.
Oh, okay. All right, so I hear you saying that I should not boycott Star Wars?
Yeah, just go see it. Yeah,
bring my kids. I've got three kids.
Get over it. Start with the black and white and boogie on down to gray.
Have faith in your kids that they're going to be able to see the gray.
Right. ask them what it means afterwards.
But in 8 seconds, that's all you've got. That's all you've got.
All right, there's your solution. Go and then explain. We'll see how much you can see the grays when it comes to 405 tolls and campus speech and praying in football fields. Stay tuned. KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. I've just been reminded that George Lucas made a Star Wars about democracy and process and trade agreements and the Imperial Senate, and people hated it.
Oh, you know, that's a great point.
Phantom Menace?
Yeah, well, I remember that. It shows that the process of democracy doesn't make good storytelling. Mm-hmm. So those scenes really dragged, and you couldn't wait for them to be over and get back to the Jedi Knights.
Get back to Evil Empire.
Right.
This is what Star Wars gave us, Evil Empire, the Star Wars Space Defense Initiative. So forget the process.
I just
go right to totalitarianism. Versus evil.
It's just storytelling, because I thought that I was watching a committee hearing in 70mm.
Well, this sounds like Obama's press conference. I'm just saying.
We're talking with Paul Guppy from Washington Policy Center, State Senator Pramila Jayapal, Seattle Channel's Joni Balter, and this is The Week in Review. Here's the problem. Next problem. We solved the last one. Go to Star Wars and then parent. Here's the next problem. You just want to get where you're going. You want to get in your car, preferably alone, so you don't have to speak to anyone. You want to get on a freeway because it's free. You want to drive 60 miles an hour because it's right there on the sign. But no, on 405 between Bellevue and Linwood, where it was already crowded enough, the state took a lane away, and now they make you pay as much as $10 to get into your old lane that used to be free, and sometimes it's still congested. But State Transportation Department spokesperson Jennifer Charlebois says the express toll lanes are working. They can give drivers a boost when they're in a pinch.
So when drivers need to get someplace on time when they have an appointment or need to catch a plane at the airport or need to pick up their kids on time, they have that option to get that more reliable trip when they need it.
So now there's a bill coming to the legislature to return one of these express toll lanes back to general traffic and make it free to drive alone at night. So I ask you, we have crowded freeways that cost money to maintain. We have angry drivers, many of whom can't afford these toll lanes. What do we do about it?
Well, I actually think these things are working. I know that there was a column written that talked about $10 isn't enough, which actually, if you analyze that evening of traffic region-wide, you know, the toll lanes finally hit they sometimes are 75 cents, but they went up to $10 to get in there. And people were like, oh, my gosh, all these people were in there. So maybe this doesn't work. But actually, it does work because, you know, it's almost like the surge pricing of Uber.
By the way, let me just say the theory is that the toll should be even higher because that's how congestion pricing works. If you want to discourage people, if you want to clear those lanes out, for then make the tolls even higher. Go on.
So what it reminded me of was a lot of things. It reminded me of Uber's surge pricing on New Year's. Try to get an Uber. The whole world wants an Uber, so it gets more expensive on New Year's Eve. Sometimes 9 times as much as it would be in a regular evening ride. So airplanes do it. Hotels do it. I think that those lanes work that evening. And if you think about it, over in Seattle, I was trying to get somewhere.
So wait, you're in favor of congestion pricing, but you want to put a lid on it. You don't want it to be $30 to get into the lane if that's how much.
I mean, I don't know where it's going. Somebody said something about $16 or something in Florida. No,
okay.
We have $10. We're experimenting with it.
Yes.
Let's see how it works. I'd probably join in the party of removing the tolls from 7 p.m. to 5 a.m.
Okay. So, Joni, you're saying we have the solution. It's what we have now, except tweak it with drive for free at night, Senator?
Well, I think that this is part of a bigger conversation. I'm not generally in favor of tolling because I think it's another fairly regressive way of dealing with a situation. So
regressive tax in Washington.
If you're rich, then you get to use it. If you're poor, you don't. And so, by people who can afford it using those lanes, the theory is that it would free up the other lanes for people who can't afford it. I mean, that's the whole theory behind tolling. But I think that there's a bigger question about why we don't invest more in transit in this state, because if we invested in transit and if we had, say, a light rail line or some sort of a commuter service that goes from Bellevue to Seattle or to Renton along that 405 corridor, what would happen then? We've never invested in transit in this state. It's all locally paid for. Our gas taxes can only go to roads and highways. So we end up in the situation where, A, we don't have enough transit and other options for people other than taking their cars. And we have way too many people taking only one person in a car. But also, we need to have more revenue to work on all of this. And so to me, it comes back to we're creating revenue through these tolls. That's what we're doing. We're getting money in order to then be able to pay for some of the highway improvements. All these big companies have come into Redmond, for example, where a lot of that traffic is worst from that in that corridor. That's where these toll lanes are operating. But they're not necessarily paying the taxes that they need to pay in order to invest in the infrastructure we need to have so that we can service all those people that have to drive now from one place to another in order to get to work.
So you're saying, number one, spend more on transit. Number two, what, income tax?
Number two, have some sort of a tax system that gets money from corporations and from our wealthiest folks that can then be invested in the collective. Because to me, roads are the collective.
Okay.
And we need to invest in our roads and our highways, which we finally did by gas tax, which is also regressive.
Right.
So, I think that we're talking about tolling because that's the only thing that's in front of us right now. But
not on Week in Review. We're coming up with, we're bigging up the picture
which
on
I'm
this.
Very excited about.
Okay.
But not a solution. And, that hasn't been a solution in the state legislature.
Right. There's a solution. Mr. Guppy, spend more in transit, tax corporations and the wealthy, and then tolls wouldn't be such a problem.
Well, I think tolls are a tool that can be used to add capacity or add choices in a corridor where there aren't enough lanes. So I think tolling has been used in other states to add a lane to create the investment in the infrastructure. What upsets people on the east side, I think, about 405 is that the DOT, in its wisdom, took away lanes that already existed or were planned to be general purpose or HOV lanes and slapped a toll on them. And I think people just find that offensive, that they have to pay.
But you don't have a right to the lane just because you had a right to it five minutes ago.
In a way, you do have a right to the lane because the government runs a monopoly in which only they are able to supply highway lanes. Only they build public roads. Nobody
else can. Except the government has consistently had its hands tied on how it raises revenue to pay for those things.
We just had a gas tax increase.
We literally just passed it.
I want to hear Paul's solution.
Yeah.
Okay. Have you told us yet?
So if you look at the larger model, if the government is going to have a monopoly on highways and be the only supply for providing highway lanes, then they need to provide options for people, including HOV and general purpose. On the east side, as I said, they took
We have both away. HOV and general purpose.
Well, we have fewer because
so you're
they
saying,
turned them into toll lanes.
So you like
that's
this
where the
bill.
Source of that bill comes from.
You say make one of these express toll lanes back into a general purpose lane.
Which is what DOT promised when these lanes were first planned, something like 5 or 10 years ago. So I like the bill for that reason. But the larger issue is not using tolling to take away lanes that people already had access to. And as far as companies on the east side go, there are states that allow private companies to build a highway and to toll it, and it's a user fee. And if you want to drive on that highway, you pay for
it. Sometimes it looks like Houston, however, right?
And sometimes you drive on the public road. So we have to decide whether public roads are truly public and available to everyone, like a public park, equal access paid with general taxes, which is I'm in favor of that, or to use an alternative model of having some people pay. The wealthy will always just pay.
Yeah.
So we have to think about what is the public interest.
We have other topics to cover, but what I'm hearing is, Joni, we have the solution, plus let's drive free at night.
Paul and I agree that roads should be public and people should pay the appropriate amount of taxes to pay for those roads.
Okay. But you want one of these lanes to go, Paul, to revert to general purpose lane. It's, Senator Jayapal, you want to spend more on transit tax the corporations and the wealthy. I didn't hear a single person say the solution is carpool. Join up with two other people and drive for free. What's the problem? Why is that not the solution?
Well, I think that's definitely something we want, but that's a solution for how you deal with, I don't know. I mean, I think that's a culture change, right? We got to
because we hate each other.
Yeah,
we need to learn to love each other.
Yeah.
But here comes Star Wars telling us that there's a good chance that the person next to us is a rebel.
I'm
going to
make sure you
whatever
do not
see
you know, Star Wars. I don't think it's going to be good for you.
In Singapore, they have, for the downtown area anyway, which gets very congested, they have this zone, right? You can't go into the zone without three people. I mean, that could get people into a car.
Let's
with
get
a
together,
zone.
People. Yeah. Yes, we're wrapping this up. Yes.
Absolutely. So maybe to throw a new idea out there, it's an existing mm-hmm. idea actually, is Metro runs van pools where any private person can apply to run mm-hmm. a van. With an app and a website, you can get together with your neighbors, get six or seven people, and ride the van to work. That works great. But Metro has limited how much people are allowed to do that because it competes with the buses.
All right. So there's another solution. Come together, people. All right. Can we come together on the football field? A public high school's football field, no matter our religion. That's coming up on the Week in Review. Joni Balter, Pramila Jayapal, Paul Guppy, I'm Bill Radke. We're on Twitter at KOW, on Facebook, KOW Public Radio, solving the problems of the week. Check and check and check. Here's a new problem. Some of today's college students feel oppressed, overlooked, psychologically assaulted. They want an end to dismissive words and actions, they sometimes called microaggressions. They want trigger warnings on course material that might cause them mental anguish, maybe because of trauma they've suffered. This week, a Washington State representative says students have gone too far.
Over and over, we have just seen this environment on college campuses where if I don't like what you say, then I can label you and in an almost McCarthyistic manner drive you from the academy simply because I don't like what you're saying. I mean, we have crossed a Rubicon here where free speech has become just a speed bump to drive over in order to pursue your political agenda.
Representative Matt Manweller, an Eastern Washington Republican, his solution is a bill that, among other things, says Washington State professors don't have to warn students of potentially offensive material, and Washington universities cannot sanction students, faculty, or staff who use microaggressions. That's his solution to the dilemma of free speech on campus and raising the kind of adults that we want to raise. What's your solution?
I'm thinking that if this gets carried to its illogical extension here, we can't even say the representative's name, Manweller. A little offensive.
Okay, a little bit
on the male, female. I think we got to be darn careful here that we're going to raise a whole generation of wimps who don't, you know, college is where stuff happens. I'm not trying to be offensive, and I don't want things to be offensive, but sometimes, you know, course material is going to be offensive, and you really have to do a trigger alert. What time does the trigger alert have to happen? I do a little bit of teaching around here, and I actually don't know what time that alert has to go out if this gets out of control, and it is already out of control.
So would you support legislation like this?
You know, I had to see the exact details. I read the stories and everything like that.
Okay, but bigger picture, you want today's kids, and you have kids.
I do. I do.
If it's a microaggression or there's a difficult material,
yes.
Get used to it. That's life.
That's life. I don't know that it needs to come from the legislature. I think it should come from college administrators.
Okay. Senator?
Well, this is, you know, a complicated issue, and it's much bigger, I think, than course offerings. And most of the context for microaggressions is not about what's in course offerings. It's mostly about many things that are said and implied on two people. And we're in a situation where we've got a strong, powerful Black Lives Matter movement that's emerged. Most of our college campuses are not representative of minority communities. So you've got primarily, I mean, that's why, is it called I2M Harvard, you know, and some other groups like that that have started to say, we need to raise the percentages of people of color that are in our universities because academia has not always been friendly. And in the end, we are talking about creating an environment. To me, the colleges, college campuses, academia is about creating a welcoming environment where everyone feels like they can learn. And I can tell you that when you have constant things that are hurled at you.
Will you give some examples, please?
Yeah,
Everybody doesn't know.
Here's easy ones that I get all the time. You speak English so well.
You get that personally?
All the time. What was your name because I look Indian.
Yeah.
Oh, you speak English so well. Mm-hmm. After 50 times of being told what my name is, still not being able to get it. Now,
but why is that a microaggression? Not everybody knows about all this. Why is that an aggression?
Microaggressions, and I don't react to all of these things. Really, most of the time, I just tell people what my name is again. Because if we were to react to every microaggression, many of them would not be worth reacting to. Some of them, however, would be. And for those of us who are people of color, who are minorities, who hear this kind of thing all the time. I mean, I have African-American students who come in and tell me that they wanted to study biology. In fact, there was a great article in The Atlantic that talked about this. And it was an African-American student who, I think it might have been biology, wanted to study biology. And went to her advisor with it, and the advisor looked at her without even looking at her academic record, which was fantastic, by the way, and said, maybe you should look at easier things like African-American studies. Now, this was a Black student. So this kind of thing is happening all the time. And
to
look...
advisor.
Well, yeah. Okay, but you can't just say, get a different advisor, get a different friend, get a different, you know, professor. Because
I'm not being flip.
I'm patiently
waiting my turn. So
I know, but I really think that fundamentally we all are making decisions every single day about what we respond to and what we don't. That's the burden that we have. And that's fine. I'm not complaining about it. But that's the reality, is we do not respond to everything that is out there. But how do we create an environment on college campuses where people do not constantly hear racist slurs? Because that is the environment in which we're operating. There is racism. There is structural racism.
How do we create that environment?
I think you do it. To me, the whole discussion around microaggressions is interesting because I think by allowing a discussion to occur around what a microaggression is, you actually create understanding amongst people about why things are offensive or not offensive.
Good. And why can't you do that without safe spaces? Why can't you do that within
That's
the context
college.
Because
of college.
It feels very dangerous for a lot of people to be constantly put in a situation. I think if you haven't experienced this, it's very difficult. But when you're constantly being told somehow that you're less than or your intellect is less than because you're a certain person, because you're a certain religion, because you're a certain gender, it is extremely difficult to constantly have to counter that.
Okay, I haven't heard from Paul yet.
Why not create those situations where we actually are using those to be able to talk to each other? And then people can say, I'm not saying people are meaning to do this. A lot of times, I think very well-meaning people say things, me included, that are very offensive. But at least we get to have
a
conversation.
You're looking right at me like I'm the source of the
microaggression. No,
go ahead, Paul.
No,
I know you want to respond.
Because I knew you were next in the response line. I promise, Paul.
Sure thing.
Yeah.
I basically feel, I mean, America's a great country, I think. And what makes it great is all the tremendous diversity of people, which is increasing, by the way. So we've always had an immigrant history. That's what built the country. And that is even increasing more in the 21st century. And I think that's a good thing. So that's general society. Regarding college, I don't think anyone has a right to not be offended. That's why it's a tremendous privilege to go to college. I see these protests happening in the middle of the workday, and I'm thinking there are other young people the same age as these students who are not in college, who are working, and in fact are paying taxes so that those students can be at a state university, for example. So that's the reason you go to college, is to be exposed to ideas, to debate ideas, to be offended, be insulted. I mean, it's a tough world out there.
So you don't need, you don't think we need to change anything we're doing?
Well,
right?
Yeah, well, that's the next question, is the administration of the school.
What do we do about it?
In a lot of ways, the way that the administration and the leadership of the universities is handling it, I think, has been clumsy and awkward. I do know that among sort of conservative intellectual opinion, there's a lot of laughing on the sidelines because the academy has been dominated by the left for 30 or 40 years. So it's like, you created this problem, you know, you deal with the protests. But as far as running the university goes, I think that the leadership needs to make it clear that it's an academic environment where people have voluntarily come to enhance their intellectual abilities and to grow and to debate and to be exposed to ideas that maybe they don't like.
Okay.
But the solution to speech that you don't like is more speech. So that I think more free speech should be allowed.
Okay.
I just want to say one thing, though, which is that I think what these protests are about is bringing empathy and compassion and understanding into how we debate.
And that is speech, Paul. So maybe we're coming together here, right? You're both calling for more speech, including you're saying, let's have this conversation. It's okay to stand up and say these microaggressions are not okay. That's more speech.
Sure, but you have to be willing to accord goodwill to the other person and not so narrowly parse everything that they say that you label it as a microaggression when the person who was speaking didn't even intend that.
No, it also gets completely out of hand if you think about the costume situation at Yale, where there's all but a list of okay costumes, and then a professor who says, I think we're going a little too far, is all but forced out. It's a little much.
But let's be clear that there's also situations where students are threatened with lynching, where there are those sometimes come out of microaggressions that escalate. Okay, and once they escalate,
call the police. See, my attitude is, if somebody is violating the law, don't call the university. Call the cops, okay? This person is being aggressive against me. He's threatening me. On Facebook, they said they wanted to lynch me.
Okay.
We're
not disagreeing. We're talking about the stuff in the middle. Okay. Right, where,
kind of. But I think I'm also saying that I think it's very easy to dismiss things as being unimportant.
When they're about identity,
if you're in the majority identity, you get to define what is okay and what's not okay. And when you are in the minority identity, you have to go with that definition. And one of the things the United States is going to have to deal with is that we are becoming a majority-minority country.
Okay, permit me to pause, because we will have many. We're doing a survey this hour of several things that came up this week, and I know we'll have more chance to talk about campus speech. For one reason, we have this bill in the legislature. It's about to convene in January, and this state representative again is saying that. That the campus protests have gone too far, I think agreeing with two of our guests, that we ought to keep universities places of rigorous intellectual discourse and that we ought to let it fly. And we're hearing from Senator Jayapal. Let's have the conversation, but let's talk about what's a microaggression and what's dismissive speech and what's acceptable speech. More to come on that, right? Can we agree?
Yeah. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Let's agree.
All right, there you go. More of Week in Review coming
up. Topic.
The conversation is happening on Twitter at KUOW and in your ears and in this room. I'm Bill Radke with my guests for the Week in Review, Paul Guppy, Pramila Jayapal, Joni Balter. Today, we're going to talk about transportation and how we act on our beliefs. Taxis can be a drag, okay? You call a dispatcher who, for some reason, seems to hate you.
And or there is that.
If you're lucky and the taxi shows up, it's kind of expensive. So here come app-based services like Uber that are cheaper and easier, but their drivers are not making the extra money or the vital money they thought they would. This week, we talked to Don Gearhart with the Teamsters Union, who told us some Uber drivers are making $2.64 an hour.
There's this interesting dichotomy where we're looking at a city that embraces technology, embraces innovation, wants to have fewer cars on the road, but at the same time, we have a largely refugee, largely immigrant workforce who's on the road making, you know, one-fifth of what we say people should make per hour, and still trying to say that that's okay because it's flexible, or that's okay because it happens at a smartphone.
This week, the Seattle City Council gave drivers the power to unionize, a move that Uber fought to prevent. Senator Pramila Jayapal, you're basically pro-union, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Will you tell the people of Washington right now that it's unethical to take Uber in light of their anti-union stance?
Well, I don't take Uber because I've been really disappointed in how they've engaged with government and regulation. And I think innovation is great and apps are great, but I really don't like their attitude, which is we're going to come in and we're going to do whatever we want. And no, you can't tell us what to do because we're just going to raise more capital and buy our way into a system. So should cabs have insurance? Yes. Should they be paying their workforce a certain amount if we have a minimum wage law in place? Yes. They should be following the same rules that everyone else is. Have they done a great service by you know, really jolting our cab companies to take customer service seriously and, you know, innovating? Sure, they have. I'm happy to have more competition. I just don't want one set of competition to be operating with completely different rules. And I think that's where Uber is. They started out calling themselves a cab company and then they changed it because they didn't. Now they talk about how they're only an app. They're not a cab company because they're only doing the technology part, which is just ridiculous because what they're doing is providing the service that takes the cab. So
okay.
I don't take Uber.
Don't take Uber. Paul Guppy, Uber, it brings competition, but are they also so dismissive that we ought to let them know what we think by not riding in their cars?
Well, I mean, I think Uber has to meet basic safety and insurance requirements because that's consumer protection,
yeah,
number
exactly.
one, and number two, it's public safety. So they have to do that. I don't take Uber just because I'm technologically not so fast. So
it's so much
now it comes out. Now it comes out.
Really,
or I haven't gotten around to it. I don't know. I have my own car. But I think what the problem that I see is I'm pro-union as well. I'm all in favor of unions as long as they're voluntary. Now, the unions don't like that because they want their membership to be mandatory. And that's my disagreement with the Teamsters coming in and trying to organize the Uber drivers, is that if they get up to a certain level of signatures among the drivers, 51%, then everybody has to join the union or else you are illegally barred from driving, you're banned from driving for Uber no matter what your choice is. And I think that's wrong. And secondly, I think Uber is responding to customers and the market, which I think is good. And we live in a fast-moving digital economy. Seattle is on the leading edge of this. And I think the city council is running the risk of destroying that entire reputation, that destroying is too strong of a word, but dampening our leading edge position in the digital economy by layering on these regulations,
okay.
particularly mandatory union membership, which I think would be a mistake.
So Uber is responding to the market. So if you could take it, you would. When you
figure it out,
you will.
And I'm sure that I will.
Okay.
So haven't yet.
So if you want the ride, figure it out and take it.
Right.
That's
yes,
why
Johnny.
You take Uber. You take Uber because you need a ride, not because you're trying to make some political statement, I would think.
So you take it, do you take it regardless of all the background radiation,
yeah,
Johnny?
But there's other radiation that goes with it, too. It's that Uber caters to folks who may or may not have a car.
Right.
Uber gets, you know, out of the whole fight over parking, which involves people going around in circles around blocks, which adds to traffic.
They're doing just as much, whether you agree or not, they're doing good.
There's other points to why people take Uber, and I do have it on my phone.
Okay, so if you think of yourself.
I have it on there. I mean, I've taken it from time
to
time.
But their prices, what's going to happen
too,
next,
but,
though?
I want to know, Senator, you rarely take it, but you take it. So you've got the app, and you use Uber. Where are you? Why don't you put your beliefs that you so eloquently expressed behind not taking Uber?
Because the only place I will take it is in Washington, D.C., when you can't call a cab.
Because they're twinned.
And,
they're twinned.
And out of, when you're out in the South Capitol, you can stand on a corner for a very long time, like 45 minutes. So literally the only place I've ever taken it is D.C. And
okay.
the only, and I actually stopped taking it. This was before all the stuff came out about Uber and before I heard Uber testify before us in the state legislature and read all the stuff that happened. This was maybe like 2 years
ago. So maybe you wouldn't take it now, even in D.C.
I don't take it now.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I don't know.
I also think Uber should be subject to public pressure, public opinion.
Right.
That all companies have to respond to that and to.
This is my question. How do you express your public, your opinion
sure.
when you need a ride?
Sure.
Joni,
so
I haven't heard from you.
Consumers choose not to use it, that will send a signal to the company.
Okay.
You've heard from me. I take Uber when I need
you
a ride.
Okay.
But also, one thing to consider here, once they unionize here in Seattle, it'll probably spread across the country, and prices are going to go up. So when people do their little quick mental calculation, should I call a cab, should I grab a bike, should I take Uber, one thing that's going to factor in is their prices
right.
are going to go up once they're unionized.
I don't think that's a bad thing. I want my workers to be paid, you know, $15 instead of $263. Right?
It reflects our values, income inequality in this city.
Right.
It
and
reflects
a sector
our
of
values.
The digital economy becomes less nimble and there's less of it.
Well,
okay.
It has a deterrent effect.
True, but if the point is just to innovate at any cost, that's a very different position than we're going to innovate but still make sure we are consistent with our values. And I would say that Seattle's on the leading edge of making sure that we're addressing income inequality at the same time that we're seeing, you know, tremendous growth.
Okay.
I need to pause again because this
mandatory union membership is not my value.
Okay, so the Seattle City Council has given drivers the power to unionize. So now where you come in, you listener, is will you take this service or not? What message, as free market Paul Guppy said, what message are you going to send Uber? You're next. You make that decision. More of the Week in Review just ahead. Thank you for tuning in to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke. This week, a Bremerton High School football coach was praying to his Christian God on the field after the games. Some players were joining him, so you had a prayer circle forming. Somebody objected that because the coach was acting as a public school official on public school grounds, this amounted to establishment of religion. This week, that coach filed a federal discrimination complaint against the Bremerton School District. So, if we want people to freely exercise their religion, but we don't want to establish a state religion, what do we do?
Well, I would say this case is no longer about Bremerton. It's no longer about this coach. It's been sort of taken hostage here a little bit by the right wing. This thing has gotten out of control. And I think that this coach is sort of, I'm surprised he doesn't realize a couple of things. First of all, as a coach, you are an authority figure. You know, he acts like it doesn't matter who he plays and that who he gives his attaboys to. It matters to the students. They don't want to be on the wrong side of the coach.
Okay.
I think we can pretty much
agree. No, I don't agree
with
that, no.
Well, okay, we'll get to that but in a second. But anyway, why does it have to be on the 50-yard line? Why does it have to be midfield? Why doesn't
So what's
he go,
the better so better
he
idea?
Can go over somewhere that's not like in everyone's face and do whatever he wants to do.
Pray privately, as,
pray
by the
privately.
Way, I believe Jesus tells us to do in the Bible.
He doesn't have to make this a political thing.
I
think he's out of
pray behind closed doors or something like that. I don't have the Bible in
front of me. That's when you examine your conscience with God, to examine your own activities privately.
So you say the solution is let him pray privately.
Privately,
we don't have a
not in our face, and don't pretend that you don't have power over these young folks. Peer pressure is the biggest deal in the world when you're that age.
Okay, Paul?
Yeah, so to me, the key is whether it's voluntary. And, you know, you can't, not everybody can be protected from being uncomfortable or feeling peer pressure. That's just the nature of the world. Kids feel peer pressure just walking down the hall of their school. So that can never be eliminated. But I don't think that people check their civil rights when they take a job with the school district. And government at all levels is pervasive throughout our society now, unlike in the past. And so I think we have to be more flexible and accommodating or tolerant. I don't think that this issue needed to become a big international or national debate. I agree with that.
You can thank us media for that.
Yeah.
Go on.
I think the local school district could have handled it a little better by being tolerant of the coach's desire to separately and voluntarily pray with his students after the game.
Not on the field with all those people.
Maybe in a different location. Sure, that's maybe in the parking lot.
Well, this is the important question. Is it not infringing on this man's rights to make him pray privately?
Well, this is what I mean about the reasonable accommodation.
Yeah, what's reasonable?
You know, how can you exercise your prayer? If he insists, then I guess you're going to end up in court. But
yeah.
Well, he does insist, or his friends insist.
Where this is going. But my point is that there, you know, this kind of barrier to expressing your faith in public begins to impinge on our freedom as citizens. I mean, that's what's
why. Why does it impinge on his rights? Why can't he express his faith in private?
He could, but why can't he express it in public?
Well, we know all the whys, but like,
but
right?
That's freedom. Your employer comes to you and says you may not engage in this activity. That's like limiting your freedom of speech,
okay,
or limiting your freedom to buy property or engage in business or any of the other parts that are part of civil society. That's what I mean. So the coach is trying to express his faith as part of our civic society voluntarily.
Yeah.
And no student or player should have consequences if they don't go to the prayer session. And if that's the case, then the coach is violating their rights.
Right. Okay. So let him pray.
The school district is being unnecessarily tough on this employee.
Let him pray where he wants. Senator?
I'm with Joni on this. I mean, I just think that, you know, we have a separation. We have this person that's in a position of authority. And I think in the end, you know, if I read the story correctly, he was actually first doing it before the game. And so there was a previous incident and he first did the prayer before the game, I think in the locker room or something, or maybe it was on the field.
What should we let him do now?
He was told not to.
Uh-huh.
So I'm just saying this wasn't like out of the blue. He did this after the game and nothing had happened. He did it before the game. There was clearly pressure and it was not appropriate. He was told not to do that. So then he did it after the game, but still on the field.
And why is that not a reasonable accommodation?
Because to me, that's still, you know, it's still right there in the middle of everything. It's still right after the game when students are celebrating, and he should be celebrating with all of the students in a way that makes everybody feel good about whatever happened on the field.
What about this? What if the school district said, separate from the court, or let's say the court even set rules that we don't know. Let's say the court says that he's not allowed to pray there, and you're right. But what if this district were to say, okay, established, you don't have a right to pray when and where you want. It's public,
sure.
You're a public school official, public field.
Right.
And now we're going to let you and there's apparently a Buddhist assistant coach, everybody, you know, have a prayer, atheist, have a pizza party, you know, right next to every. We're going to have a be in after the field, and we accommodate everybody. Does that solve the problem?
I don't think so, though. I grew up in a country that's pluralistic, and I actually grew up with a lot of religions. I was telling somebody just before that I played Jesus in seventh grade, you know, in a Baptist church.
Diversity.
And I had a lot of Muslims, and so I've always been. I like faith, actually. I don't. I'm spiritual. I'm not necessarily religious, but. I don't have a problem with that, but I think the problem is if you invite anybody to do whatever and it's still in the public, there's still a lot of people who are very uncomfortable with any kind of religion. I mean, the United States has a very large percentage of people who are not religious. It's been continuing to increase, and I think the key thing here is, you know, we want to make sure that we maintain the separation on public grounds. And
so you're saying even an inclusive bunch of different kind of prayers impinges on the rights of atheists?
I mean, I'd rather have that than, you know, just one prayer.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that keeping your religion private and in your own, and then having places where you can go publicly express it and, you know, is fine. But I'd rather keep them separate. I think it's cleaner.
But the problem is,
you each get two sentences and then we're moving on.
I'll make it quick. First of all, I don't think the government is obligated to make everybody feel comfortable. So you're going to feel uncomfortable. It's just like being on
campus. We just said that about campus speech.
Exactly. Yeah. So I think we have to be tolerant and flexible about that. The second thing is that as the administrative state gets larger, I mean, the government is at every level is larger and larger. Community centers, city parks, and all the spaces around us are many of them, rather, are ministered by the government. If we have this rule that you can't engage in your civic
Is that
culture,
even true that government is getting larger? I mean, you think about FDR.
Well,
you think
okay, this
about,
discussion is getting larger, which I appreciate.
My point is, I think we just have to be. It's,
we added water.
To
saying, I just want to challenge that.
But our 60 minutes, our hour is not expanding. You see, we have the okay.
Well, why can't you fix that for us?
I'm going to fix it right now.
Of religious expression in public.
I thank
you. But I just want to say one quick, Bill. I promise. One other quick.
Does it take negative amount of time?
No. Context is in a moment when we are actively opposing particular religions like Islam that are happening at a national level. And here we have, you know, a situation where I think you got to look at the context of how we're excluding certain people because of their religion, because it is also a part of this.
This guy's okay. Making this about himself and the group that's backing him up. I would chill if I were him. I really would.
Okay, there's
the school district should chill.
Okay. We've got a lot of recommendations that you should chill. Can we agree to that?
Yeah.
Sure.
Okay, let's chill. Yeah. All right, well, this coach has filed this federal discrimination complaint, and we'll follow that on KUOW and back at Week in Review in a moment. We've solved almost all the world's problems, and we're nearing the end of the hour with Senator Pramila Jayapal, Paul Guppy, Joni Balter. I'm Bill Radke. Imagine you made a mistake. You committed a crime, got convicted, served your sentence. Now you would like to have a roof over your head. So you try to rent an apartment, but the ad says felons need not apply. This week, a tenant rights group asked the city of Seattle to require landlords to consider renting to convicted criminals. Murph Eamon with Columbia Legal Services says landlords can't tell who's going to be a bad tenant.
The statistics show that a person with a criminal history is just as likely to reoffend as someone who has no criminal history at all. And so what we want are fair, sensible tenant screening policies that help people find housing who are perfectly capable of renting and just have something on their record.
Now, imagine your job is to rent apartments to people who you're guessing will pay their rent on time, not trash the place, and not commit crimes in your building. Evan Leffler is a Seattle attorney who works with landlords. He says landlords have the right to profile people. In fact, that is their job.
When somebody comes to you and says, I want to do business with you, is you look at their past history of doing business. And to take something as severe as a criminal record off the table as something that you consider seems to me to be overly restrictive.
There you have the dilemma. Joni, what's
the answer? I think this is a darn close call, I'll be honest with you, but I also think...
I'm going to always assume you're being honest unless you tell me differently.
All right.
That's go on.
Phrase. But once you pay your debt to society, I mean, that really is the bargain here. Once you've paid your debt to society, you're at least entitled to housing. That's what it seems to me. Now, I get the other argument. I really do. And I understand, like, I have a lot of, shall we say, women friends who are in the dating market. And they run, because they are so good at data, they run prospective dates through the data. So that's why it's sort of close and sort of troubling to me. But I do think I lean clearly toward once you've paid your debt to society, you got to have some housing.
Okay. Require landlords to consider renting to convicted felons. Yes, Paul. They can't just exclude.
It's not required.
Oh, I see.
It's banned that.
They have to consider it. They have to can't exclude people just because of conviction. What do you say, Paul?
Exactly. So I would agree with that. As you know, I'm always hesitant when the government is imposing new restrictions on people. But in this case, I think it's a matter of barring sort of blind discrimination. I mean, to advertise felons need not apply before you've even spoken to this person, I don't think that's right. I also think, again, from a kind of civil libertarian point of view, that if you've made a mistake in your life and you served your time and you've cleaned the sheet, you should be able to rebuild your life and get started.
See, I didn't predict you were going to say that.
Well,
I find that interesting.
You know, my wife and I work with foster kids, and if you looked at the record of some of these teenage foster kids, you would never do business with them. So as they become young adults, they need a chance to be able to start in life, and I think that's true of anybody.
Senator Jayapal, agreed?
So agree. And, you know, I think that you look at all of the ways in which we say to people, you did something wrong, we're going to punish you. Okay, fine, we do that. But then there are so many ways that once they've been punished and they've served their time, they have no way of rehabilitating.
It's like it follows them.
It really is. And yet we say to them, we want you to build a new life, but we don't give them the tools. So LFOs, legal financial obligations, are another part of that where you keep accruing interest while you're in jail. jail, mm-hmm. and then you come out and you went in maybe with $2,000 in debt, you come out with $20,000 in debt, then we don't have Ban the Box in most places. I mean, obviously we do in Seattle, but in a lot of places you can't get a job because you were, you know, you did something wrong. And so I'm just so all in with this policy. And okay. I think ultimately, you know, landlords still get to decide who they're going to rent to, but sure. you can't ban
okay.
somebody.
Complete agreement. We have one more topic I want to get to. So I'm just going to run this past the free market guy. What about this? Instead of telling the landlord, this is how you have to run your private business. Mm-hmm. What if the government, what if the city just gave financial incentives? Here, if you will rent to a convicted yeah. felon, here's some money. Then you don't have...
Well, right? I would like that even less. So,
oh, okay.
So on a apartment application, you can't... I'm sure it's illegal to ask someone's religion, to ask their, you know,
yep.
ethnicity, which is irrelevant. And also, as far as business goes, landlords require first, last month's rent
yeah.
plus a damage deposit.
Right. Yeah.
So
right.
you're paying up front in case there's a problem further down the line with the tenant.
Okay. Got it. Three votes for saying yes to this.
Consider we all agreed
this.
With each
Yipes.
Other.
Let's not Ooh. Do that again.
Yes. Well, I love it when we agree. Okay. We're going to watch that. The city's going to consider ban the box, the check box on whether there's a conviction when it comes to renting housing. Okay. Wrapping up the week in review. By the way, I just want to say to our young listeners, if you're worried that Santa won't visit you because you've been naughty this year, good news, kids, because Santa grades on a curve. And this week we learned that the CEO of Turing Pharmaceuticals was so naughty that oh. you now make Santa's cut, because unless you acquired the rights to a life-saving drug and then jacked up the price by 5,000%, you didn't do that. You just kept bouncing the ball in the house. Okay, but you didn't allegedly rob another drug company to pay back your hedge fund clients.
Sorry.
You're good with Santa. Okay, Santa says you're okay.
That's just bad.
Now,
so bad.
Take the ball outside, kid. Okay, last thing. This week, KOW brought you the story of Seattle's Black Santa. A photographer and a friend teamed up to offer kids a chance to take photos with a Santa who doesn't look like your typically depicted Santa. Well, Santa's changed for centuries. He doesn't have to look like Dumbledore. If Santa can have dark skin, can Santa be a woman? A British ad agency put that question to some children, and Jason, I don't see the audio in there, which is sort of the point of this. So the we'll see if we can get it in, even though we only have like a minute left in the show. So while we're discussing that, female Santa?
I like
oh, yeah.
it. Why not?
Right?
No. Yeah.
Which absolutely. Means presumably no beard. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Well,
does
Santa look like anything?
I think people should be able to do what they want. In the case of the Santa character, that's based on an actual historic figure.
Yeah, but
Nicholas lived in Germany.
But St. Nicholas was in Turkey originally, right?
Okay,
but anyway,
my point is
Santa doesn't have to look like St. Nicholas.
Of course not.
And as you said to me, Jesus was originally brown, but you don't see many.
There you go.
Many brown
and that's my
Jesus
point
is, around,
that,
so.
Is that the tradition starts with an actual historical figure, and then as the centuries go by, maybe it morphs into something else. And all I'm saying is just recognizing that. I mean, you're calling it St. Nicholas, Santa Claus.
But we don't
no
call
longer
it St.
Related.
Nicholas anymore.
No.
We
well,
call it Santa
again,
Claus.
Again, that's my point.
Yeah.
No longer related to
Saint
where the
Nicholas.
Tradition
Started. So can
you.
Santa Claus morph? Keep morphing. We don't have to be stuck in time.
The tradition is changing, or maybe
right.
it's not what it was before.
How about Santa as an animal?
The image is changing as well.
How about Santa is an animal?
Only in Seattle.
Or maybe Santa is
what
a dinner
kind
plate.
Of
Santa is a bird that gives out worms yeah. and lightsabers. It doesn't leave anybody out. Santa is a cat who brings to your doorstep a dead mouse and an Xbox.
And some people have Santa all year round. But... So at some point, the symbolism, the story becomes meaningless. I mean, if it's got to become, you know, Santa
I don't know
is
how
a fire hydrant, then
But after, I'm not sure how many people even know what the story is
of
now.
Course.
Okay, you see that
yeah,
sign that
point.
Says 11 seconds? That's yeah. time for me to say Paul Guppy, Joni Balter, and Senator Pramila Jayapal, thank you for coming on the Week in Review.
Thank you.
I loved it. Please
here.
Come back.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks
Merry
for joining
Christmas.
Us. Merry Christmas.